I next met with Dr. Paul Richardson, and to begin, I asked him to discuss his vision of the biology of myeloma from the perspective of the treatment strategy of maximal tumor suppression initially, followed by long-term or indefinite treatment.
The question really is incredibly complex because myeloma is such a heterogeneous disease, and most importantly, it changes within a patient over time. And I think that's something that is, for folks in practice, very challenging, because at the end of the day, this is not a leukemia or a lymphoma, which is relatively linear. This has the complexity and heterogeneity of breast cancer in the way that it interplays with its neighborhood and microenvironment. But at the same time, it's much more dangerous in a sense, because of course it's a hematologic cancer with systemic manifestations. So it has this incredible sort of, as I think of how I treat myeloma, I think of it as a chess game. And you have to make tactical and strategic decisions in patient care. So strategic decisions are based upon long-term views that now median survivals are 10. If we're lucky and doing well in a particular patient, we see 15 to 20-year survivals. Having said that, we still see in high-risk patients far shorter survivals, where 5 to 7-year survivals in aggressive myeloma can be achieved. Unfortunately, they can be even shorter than that if disease is particularly resistant to treatment. And I think what is really important to sort of grasp conceptually in myeloma is this whole issue of clonal heterogeneity and diversity and genomic instability. And we have to realize now that in the old days, when your median survival was 3 to 5 years, long-term consequences to a patient that are 10, 15 years out weren't relevant or weren't as relevant. There most certainly are now. And I think what we're realizing is that some of our old war horses were great tools at the time, but in reality, as we move into the 21st century, we have to be very much more tailored in our approach. And conceptually, I'd say this then matters in where we are with transplant. Transplant is an incredibly important modality in younger patients for sure. But having said that, how we deliver it with high-dose melphalan as our conditioning regimen, the fact that that's a highly genotoxic drug, however good it's been in the past, is very relevant to the future. So that being the case, we have to think very carefully how we use transplant, in my opinion, going forward, because we have excellent new tools. And those excellent new tools, I think, obviously include the antibodies, include the platforms of the triplet therapies that we have, include obviously other small molecules, and most importantly, the truly revolutionary new approaches in immune therapy, ranging from CAR T therapy, which obviously has shown great promise, to antibody drug conjugates, which I think are particularly fascinating, and the so-called bispecific T-cell engagers, or BiTEs, which are early but promising. And then, of course, there are a variety of other strategies that are in development in the immune space. I mean, these don't just include the antibodies and cellular therapies per se, but also the new what we call cell mods, or really these are extremely potent IMiDs, which are showing promise in early phase trials. So there's an array of new approaches that are coming that are changing the way we treat patients in the longer term. And at the same time, we also have novel chemotherapeutics that have the opportunity to be more targeted potentially and cause less injury to normal tissue. And that too may have promise as well. So an array of different opportunities for our patients that may allow us to be more tailored. And for example, at ASH last year, there were two abstracts that really caught my eye. There was RVD-DARA plus transplant, which we are part of. That was a study my colleague, Dr. Peter Voorhees, led, and I'm the senior investigator of it. And we were very pleased with RVD-DARA plus transplant. The results were outstanding. What was fascinating to me, though, was that RVD-isatuximab, in an early phase study presented by Dr. Osio from Spain, achieved a similar rate of MRD negativity as did the Griffin study with transplant, but in Enrique's study, there was no transplant used. So that was fascinating. It's a cross-trial comparison, so we have to be careful, but it's an interesting and provocative observation. And then the most important study, I think, of ASH last year in the transplant space was the Forte trial, a beautiful study led by Dr. Francesca Gay. And Francesca presented beautiful information in which she showed that KRD times 12 achieved the same thing as KRD times 8 plus transplant in terms of overall response, quality of response, and MRD negativity. Now, she updated that at ASCO with what I thought was a fascinating analysis, that if you looked at standard risk patients, the outcomes were the same, whether you had a transplant early or kept it in reserve. The high-risk patients, fascinatingly, the rate of relapse appeared higher in those who did not have the stem cell transplant at early look. The challenge with that analysis, which has to be borne in mind, is that the study incorporated a second randomization of lenalidomide versus lenalidomide carfilzomib. And obviously we don't know to which arm the patients were assigned in the context of their maintenance to date. So consequently, that high-risk group of early relapses may in fact reflect an inadequate maintenance, i.e. lenalidomide carfilzomib may not have been used in those patients who relapsed in the non-transplanted arm. And conversely, of course, it may be true that irrespective of their randomization in maintenance, the transplant made a difference. We just don't know that yet. But what I think the message was is in standard risk patients, KRD without transplant used early seemed to be performing just as well as KRD plus transplant. High risk, we need to be careful and we need to think again.
So I want to talk a little bit about some of these new strategies, and we'll get into some of them through your cases. I see your first patient, 77-year-old woman, diagnosed with lambda light chain multiple myeloma and widespread lytic bone disease in 2014.
Yeah, she's a lovely Hispanic lady who basically got initial treatment with RVD. She's 72 at the time, so consequently, we were careful. We did not actually give her RVD Classic. We gave her what I affectionately call RVD Premium Light. Excuse the beer analogy,
premium,
but essentially it's a weekly bortezomib administration over 28 days. RVD Light is the 35-day cycle that my colleague Betsy O'Donnell and my partner Jacob Laubach pioneered and published. But essentially, RVD Premium Light is an adaptation of that, which is a 28-day cycle. And that's bortezomib weekly, days 1, 8, 15, and 22 every 28 days. So she received RVD Premium Light, did very well, and was maintained.
Before you go any farther, before you move on, I just want to pick up on that initial situation. First of all, how did she present? Is she having a lot of pain?
She did. She had widespread lytic bone disease. She, in fact, had disease affecting her axial and radial skeleton. And light chain disease tends to be very bone avid, be it kappa or lambda. We always worry about lambda more because the molecule is more toxic to the kidney. And of course, it's also got a greater association with amyloid. So I always am more fearful of lambda light chain disease.
How long had she been feeling poorly and having pain?
As I recall, she had about a six-month history of malaise and discomfort, not feeling particularly well. The reality was that she presented with a fairly classical presentation then at that time, and she benefited from the combination of the three drugs plus zoledronic acid. She was maintained on RV maintenance.
I wanted to ask you, but as you treated her, how long did it take? Did she eventually get to a point where she was, feeling good?
Oh my goodness, yes. No, she responded very quickly. I mean, I think the point about light chain disease is it's exquisitely sensitive to proteasome inhibition. And as you know, proteasome inhibition is ideal at targeting bone. And so that worked very well for her. I would also stress that she tolerated her lenalidomide well. She had really minimal comorbidities. She was a very fit 72-year-old at presentation. And so basically at that time, she really did, and this was 2014, so we had plenty of data on RVD by that time to justify its use in this way.
I just want to pick up a little bit more. First of all, if she were to present again today, would you do the same thing? And I'm also curious what you think about RD daratumumab.
Great question. Great question, Neil. In terms of what I would do today, certainly RVD would remain my mainstay, particularly with lambda light chain disease and what I consider clinical high risk. I think the important point is, Neil, that the DARA data up front are very striking, and I think that that's a promising approach for her. I think what's really also important to note, though, is that fundamentally, would I do anything differently than an IMiD and a proteasome inhibitor? No, I would do the same thing today. The question would be whether or not to integrate an antibody, and I think I'd have to assess that carefully. And we can come to why, because I do think that the CD38 data up front are particularly striking. What's a little bit sobering from the RD DARA data is that the high-risk patients in that study didn't fare particularly well. And I think that would make me feel that it would have to be RVD plus DARA. Now, off protocol, that wouldn't be trivial because you'd have to be able to make sure insurance was comfortable with that, and you'd have to make sure that you could deploy it. And again, she did, simply by virtue of fact, she did very well with RVD zoledronic acid to start with.
Have you done RVD DARA off trial?
Outside of trial, I personally have not been recommending it yet. I think that DARA's approved up front for VMP. It's approved for RD-DARA. The challenge for us is how do you offer that to patients, you know, with the best triplet, which would be either KRD or RVD, plus the antibody. And how do you do that outside of a trial? Now, some patients who have particularly good insurance can get access to those quadruplets because of phase two data to support it. I think that the data still remain relatively immature. So I think that what I'm hoping is that we'll see very good, mature, high quality information to justify those four drug platforms soon. And that way, I think insurances will be much more comfortable based then on NCCN guidelines and so forth, to offer these four drug platforms up front. I do think they all have a role. I mean, we have already tantalizing data from KRD-DARA. We have the RVD-DARA from my colleague Pete Voorhees. And of course, we have the RVD-isatuximab data I touched on from Enrico Sio as well.
So again, in terms of what you might do today, what about ixazomib instead of bortezomib in this situation?
It's a great question. And ixa is a very well-tolerated proteasome inhibitor in my experience. And orally once a week, it's for an older, frailer patient. It's an excellent combination. I personally, in someone like this particular patient, given her high light chain burden, extensive bone disease, and relatively clinically high risk features, would be probably sticking with bortezomib at this stage because, frankly, you know, administering it subcutaneously, giving intravenous hydration with it, the use of a proactive approach to neuropathy, I found that it's a very manageable approach to this and very effective. I think the challenge for me with ixazomib is the once a week schedule is exquisitely well tolerated. But the activity of the once-a-week schedule has been an area in my own mind where I've always felt that, you know, I've always been particularly impressed that the twice-a-week schedule is very active too, in fact, arguably more so. And so certainly when we did our phase two experience with ixazomib up front, it was on a twice-a-week experience. And on the once-a-week experience, we were very pleased, but twice-a-week was also very active. So I would weigh that. If I was going to consider ixazomib in this patient now, I would think about twice a week versus weekly, and I would pursue that accordingly. I would stress in her case, she had no significant cardiovascular risk factors, so I would also think, of course, about cofilsimib.
So what happened next with this lady?
Well, basically, she did well on RV maintenance and had a progression-free interval of about 2 years. She then did progress, and at that point, we used the combination of pomalidomide, cofilsimib, and dexamethasone. And interestingly enough, she tolerated it well. She did respond, but, and this to me was quite ominous, her PFI was 1 year. And so that started to show me that, you know, despite the fact that I was expecting more from the CARPOM-DEX platform, to be honest, and that's when we pulled the trigger on daratumumab. We continued the POM, and we actually brought back bortezomib because I felt with her lambda light chain disease, it was important to incorporate a PI. And she tolerated it well. But again, the PFI, you know, it certainly wasn't shorter than a year, which was great. It was still a year, but it was 1 year. And then she progressed. And that was particularly important because her light chain shot up to over 1,100 mgs per liter. And essentially, at that time on staging, she not only had multiple lytic bone lesions, but most importantly, she had evidence of extramedullary disease with multiple paraspinal and pleural-based soft tissue masses and nodules. So this poor lady was not only relapsing after, I would consider, you know, gold standard therapy, i.e. CD38-based treatment, but most importantly, she was doing so with secondary extramedullary disease, which in my experience is particularly ominous. Arguably, she'd been through the best of the proteasome inhibitor family. She had had excellent immunomodulatory treatment, and she'd also had, obviously, CD38-targeting antibody treatment. So in that context, I felt pretty strongly that a cytotoxic approach made sense. And so we actually offered her participation in our phase two single-arm trial tailored for triple-class refractory patients and the melflufen study, the Horizon trial. And she actually enrolled on that. And I was very, very pleased. She actually has had an excellent, very good partial response to treatment. The important point is she's not only normalized her light chain and ratio, but strikingly, her follow-up PET CTs have also improved dramatically. So this is clear evidence of a treatment effect on her aggressive disease. And the durability of her disease control has been really quite something, Neil. She's at 1 year now.
Wow.
And ongoing.
How has she tolerated the treatment?
Well, it's funny. She herself has done very well with it. She's had us a little bit nervous because she's had significant cytopenias. But with dose reduction, we've been able to manage those. And the melflufen is a fixed dosing approach, and it's given intravenously at 40 milligrams once a month. And then we've dose reduced her, you know, first from 40 to 30, and now from 30 to 20. And her dexamethasone dosing, we've been able to preserve at 20 milligrams weekly because she was over the age of 75 when she started. Dex dosing for her was lower than it is in the trial for younger patients, which is at 40.
Looks like she had maybe more of a problem with platelets. Is that something you see with this agent?
Yeah, melflufen clearly has an effect on marrow hematopoietic precursors, but it's particularly on platelets we see it. In terms of the neutrophil count too, that can be suppressed. I think what's important though is that this myelosuppression is manageable, and what's particularly striking as well to us is that she did not have mucositis or alopecia, and that's actually what we see with this drug. We don't see off-target effects. So whilst the cytopenias are important, Neil, the fact of the matter is the off-target effects are minimal. And we're watching very carefully for some of the worries we have with melphalan, which are secondary leukemia, MDS. And thank goodness to date, that signal has been minimal in the early phase trials. But I would stress these data are early. So I think we have to be careful. But that notwithstanding, this is a very effective agent that in this particular lady's case has done a really good job for her. And frankly, in the Horizon study, you know, these are not isolated patients. We're seeing a strong signal in selected patients in terms of this. Recognizing this is a single arm trial, we have to be careful. But, you know, it's a large study. It's international, multi-center. It's over 120 patients now. And this extramedullary disease group in particular are benefiting from treatment, which we are very pleased to see.
Can you talk a little bit more? I know more data was presented from this trial that she was in at ASCO, and there's some other stuff presented on melflufen at ASCO. But you can kind of summarize the clinical research that's been done on this drug.
Well, yes, melflufen is a targeted cytotoxic, Neil, which is in its, you know, if you want to say it's in the alkylator family, it is, but it's really downstream in terms of its differentiation. If you put sort of melphalan at the very top end of it, it's kind of a great granddaughter, if you will. It's derived from the Karolinska Institute from some very important work where essentially they have used peptide conjugation as a technology to sort of build this platform where the active moiety is turned on by aminopeptidases. And aminopeptidases are enzyme systems that are highly expressed in tumor cells and exquisitely highly expressed in myeloma cells. So essentially it's a targeted form of cytotoxic. So what happens is it permeates through the hematopoietic cells of the bone marrow. It excreted, as it were, moves in and out of normal tissue. But in tumor cells, because of the presence of aminopeptidases, the targeted delivery of the active moiety is achieved. It then stays in the myeloma cell. It is not excreted from it, and it does its damage to the myeloma DNA and so forth. So, and biologically, its effects are not simply limited to intercalation of DNA. It does much more than that. There are anti-angiogenic properties seen. There are a variety of other effects. And when we've looked at it preclinically, it works in melphalan-resistant cells preclinically, and its in vivo modeling is also striking, where it works in melphalan-resistant myeloma in rodent models. And then in clinical trials to date, we've seen it work when alkylation has failed in early phase studies, and now there are a number of trials ongoing. Horizon is one. The ANCHOR study is particularly compelling. This is a study in which we're combining it with bortezomib, combining it with daratumumab, and preclinical work by my colleague Dr. Dharminder Chauhan has suggested this could be highly synergistic, and it appears to be so. In the ANCHOR data presented at EHA, my colleagues presented a response rate in the bortezomib group of 100%, which is in relapsed refractory disease, and they presented a response rate with daratumumab of 82%. Now, the numbers remain relatively small, so we have to be careful, but I would suggest to you that's quite an interesting signal, Neil, at this stage.
Globally, what is the response rates to monotherapy in relapsed disease?
That's a great question. I think it's fair to say that response rates to single agents, when you're dealing with an active drug, I think that response rates to monotherapy combined with low-dose dex usually, because that, and then people say, oh, it's the dex effect. Respectfully, that's not true. We know that from phase 3 studies, that there was a study called the ADMIR trial
which looked at weekly dexamethasone at 40 milligrams as a control arm, and the response rate was a stunning 2%. So the argument that low-dose dex confers response in relapsed refractory patients is not held up in phase 3 settings anyway. Suffice to say that the monotherapy signal from most active drugs in the setting, in my experience, is around 30%. And I think that when you look at clinical benefit rates, which reflect minimal response, which in my opinion is an active signal in early phase studies, typically it'll be about 40%. Or better. And then, of course, stable disease, which we call disease control rate or DCR, usually that's the order of 50 or 60% for active agents in this setting. The real benefit of these drugs is always much earlier, in my experience, and in combination. So with melflufen, we're seeing that sort of signal, and we think that's encouraging, particularly as, in a sense, it's a novel mechanism of action. And of course, there's been the recent data from the STORM study led by Dr. Sundar Jagannath and Achachari, in which they've shown with selinexor, which is the inhibitor of nuclear export proteins, it's a unique mechanism of action, a similar signal. So I think we know, even in the setting of triple class refractory disease, that you can see this kind of signal in active agents. My own opinion, melflufen is promising, very importantly, because of this distinct mechanism, especially when your sort of immunotherapeutic and proteasome inhibitor based strategies have failed. This cytotoxicity that sort of hits this stemness may be very important.
So, you know, it's pretty interesting being a general medical oncologist nowadays. And selinexor that you just referred to just got approved, which, you know, I think most people, including me, don't know much about either one of those. But before we get to selinexor, let's go back to melflufen, because what you're saying is kind of surprising. You know, I've been asking people about it. Nobody seems to know much about it, but I don't know, maybe they shouldn't have chosen the name, because I thought, whoa, this is like oral melphalan or some variation of chemo. It doesn't sound anything like that.
No, in fairness, you know, because it has this active moiety that it delivers to the tumor that is indeed at core an alkylator moiety, it's much more targeted, though, and much more selective. And I think that's its huge advantage. I think what's also very important is because it's able to deliver intracellularly its payload, in a way, it's a little bit like an antibody drug conjugate, where you're able to essentially get in there, deliver your missile to the nucleus, and fortunately, innocent bystanders are relatively spared. It's not without toxicity. That would be a big mistake, but its toxicity is much more manageable. And what I'm very struck by with melflufen use in this highly refractory population is the low rates of infection that we see. I mean, that's quite striking. The infection rates are low.
But again, you're talking about cytopenias, not quality of life issues.
Yeah, exactly. But my point is, we don't see, even though there's cytopenias, Neil, what's so interesting is our serious infection rates like 7%, which in this group of patients is unusual. Because with the antibodies, for example, regardless of which antibody, we definitely see infection rates that are several fold higher, not least of which because of the extensive steroid use and otherwise.
So, you know, it's kind of a weird psychologic thing, I guess, because there's so many new drugs in myeloma, the relapse space is so complicated. But I don't know, just hearing that it has a more novel mechanism kind of sounds sexier. It sounds like, you know, now it sounds like one of the novel agents that are out there to me.
Yes.
Even though the data is the data. But anyhow, I guess that's just all in our mind.
No, I think, Neil, you're hitting the nail on the head. It's what I love in myeloma is that I think you have to be broad-minded. I think it's a disease where if you approach things with blinkers, you can very easily, in my view, miss great opportunities. And I think what's really important is that it's a disease where certainly as a researcher, having imagination and a broad mind is essential, because that's actually the nature of the disease. It's extremely pleiotropic. And again, it goes back to the analogy I used earlier of a chess game. You know, this is not a linear process. And it's great to have all these various tools because they all have their respective value, in my opinion.
So more specifically, can you describe a clinical situation? Sounds like this patient is a classic situation where maybe you ought to be able to think about it.
Yeah, it's a very good point, Neil. I mean, I think in her particular case, the use of a cytotoxic agent that was targeted to minimize side effects and at the same time maximize therapeutic benefit was, you know, an ideal choice. And the proof of the pudding is in her. I mean, she has had some cytopenias. We've had a median white count ranging from 2.5 to 4.5, but we've used UCSFs, you know, judiciously to support that. And her platelet count, which had started at around 75,000, has been maintained at around 50,000 to 70,000 with the appropriate appropriate dose reductions, you know. And when she was initially dosed at much higher dose at 40, and she got significant cytopenia, I think on one occasion we transfused her for safety, not because she was actively bleeding, but because we felt it was prudent. But she's had no clinically significant bleeding. And I think that's an important point about the drug, because there isn't mucositis, because there isn't that kind of instability to epithelial membranes. The cytopenia has become perhaps, I mean, they're important, but they're less morbid in the sense that you have lower rates of infection because of the epithelium are preserved, and you don't have clinically significant bleeding on a large scale.
So I'm almost afraid to ask you about selinexor, but let's take a shot at that. What exactly is it, and where does it fit in? It just got approved.
Yes, I agree. Well, I think obviously it got approved. What I hear from, because I'm not a person on Twitter, I'm afraid, but I hear from my colleagues and friends there's been a Twitter storm since it was approved, whatever that means. I would simply say that it's an important, in my opinion, and I am a participant in the STORM study, so in full disclosure, I've treated patients with selinexor, participated in their clinical trials. I think selinexor mechanistically is particularly interesting. It's kind of in this family of targeted approaches to sort of target the myeloma genome. And what it simply does, the analogy I use, I borrow a little bit from Joe McHale, actually, who coined it first, but it's a bit like there's a rave going on at home, and somehow you want to keep the parents at home to keep things under control so that the party doesn't go completely bonkers. So what you're trying to do is keep proteins intracellularly and within the nucleus to suppress oncogenetic activity of tumor. And so essentially these tumor suppressor proteins are essential, in fact, in the normal cellular machinery in preserving genetic stability within the tumor cell. And obviously in the tumor's best interest is to pump these things out so it can become even more unstable and its mutational thrust can continue. So if you keep those proteins in, you preserve greater stability across the genome, and as a result of that, you trigger apoptosis, and it has a potent apoptotic effect because obviously the tumor itself is driving itself in an opposite direction. So these inhibitors of nuclear export protein have been a fundamental target for some time, and selinexor represents a first in class. It targets XPO1. What's so interesting about it is it's orally bioavailable. You can give it twice a week with steroid, as we did in the STORM study. What I think is particularly interesting, though, Neil, is the combination data. When you combine selinexor with bortezomib, for example, this is the so-called Boston trial, weekly dosing is proving very effective and very well tolerated in combination with weekly bortezomib. The twice-a-week schedule that we used in STORM, in my experience, is quite challenging for patients, and you have to be very attentive to supportive care. And most importantly, you have to be willing to dose reduce if you have to. So putting that all together, I think it's critical to note that you need to think of this as a novel mechanism of action. It's an orally bioavailable drug. What's fascinating from the STORM study is that in triple-class penta-exposed patients, arguably the most vulnerable population of all in our field right now, we saw a solid 30% response rate approximately. What's really important to note is that there were high-quality responses seen in a subset of patients, and what was particularly striking was that in a small subset of patients, these were highly sustained. Now, these were patients who we know their median survival is about 6 months. And in those patients who responded, the survivorship was substantially longer. And so I think, and we did actually a historical analysis using Flatiron data to corroborate this outside of the trial. So the construct that STORM is somehow completely uncontrolled is not perhaps entirely fair.
Flatiron, you mean historical controls or something?
Well, the point being that, you know, penta-refractory patients, how do we know they behave? Well, we actually do know. We know from Flatiron data, we know from other studies as well in this penta-refractory population that they do very poorly and that their median survival is about 6 months at best. So, and in fact, shorter in many experiences. So the idea of simply trying to look at how poorly this population fare because they've become triple-class refractory, penta-exposed, and effectively have no other options. The STORM trial was a study going into that population and offering them a simple combination of selinexor and dexamethasone. And remarkably in that study, a signal was seen. So I think that the accelerated approval that was given by the FDA based upon the data And especially when looked at with a very expert view from seasoned people in the field who really do look after relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, you know, I think when you look at it in that way, you can see that there is clearly an efficacy signal. And I'm particularly impressed, actually, by the large number of patients treated by Dr. Chari and Dr. Jagannath at the Mount Sinai Center, who were the lead enrollers to the STORM study. And what they refined there was a very proactive approach to supportive care. Hydration, antiemetics, really saying, look, you know, we've got a very potent drug here, we've got incredibly sick patients. This is not someone you give a pill and walk away from. This is someone you have in the office probably two or three times a week. You're hydrating them, you're giving them antiemetics. I mean, you think about it, I personally use the analogy, it's oral platinum. Think about using cisplatinum in the office. Would you just walk away from that patient and leave them alone? Absolutely not. You'd treat them with it, but you'd maximize your supportive care. And so the important point is, with maximal supportive care, a signal was seen. What I'm particularly struck by, Neil, is the activity in the Boston study. In the Boston study, which is combining it with bortezomib, the early data that have been looked at certainly point to the safety of the combination, and FDA, I think, wisely wanted to see that before they granted the accelerated approval. But I think most importantly, from investigators involved in that trial who are treating patients, you know, I've heard from them that they're seeing striking activity. So basically, putting that all together, I think there is value to this agent. I think that it's clearly finding its way now because it's in the most difficult space, which is in this triple class refractory penta-exposed group. One of the challenges that has been raised is its high price. And I think pricing in myeloma at the moment has become a real hot button issue. And I personally think we need to think very creatively about controlling drug costs going forward. That's my own view. I think it's essential.
So just at a more macro point of view, it kind of sounds like, just to compare these two, would you say it's a little more difficult to get somebody through selinexor than melflufen, for example?
Well, I would say yes. In my clinical experience, melflufen, it's a once a month infusion. Dexamethasone is given weekly. In my experience, the cytopenias with melflufen are a real challenge in the very advanced setting, but they're manageable. With selinexor, I would say you can start and see challenges, but once you get to a dose that the patient is tolerating and you've got a good supportive care plan in place, then I think the sustainability over the long term is clearly apparent and the data support that. I'm particularly struck, in fairness, Neil, by the combination data with selinexor. Right now, I have several patients I've lined up to receive it in the approved setting because, unfortunately, all major drug classes have failed them and they're in real trouble. And if I didn't have selinexor, I would actually not be able to offer them anything. So, and these are not patients who are candidates for trials. They have no counts, they're in real trouble, and I'll be very carefully offering them this drug. And again, based on the data, I'm hopeful that we'll see some benefit from it.
So let's try to do another patient who got a new therapy. Why don't we go to the 59-year-old man who got the BCMA CAR T therapy?
Right. Yeah, no, this is a wonderful gentleman who basically IgG kappa disease at diagnosis. He's now 7 years since diagnosis, but he's reflected a particularly difficult course. Interestingly, at FISH, at diagnosis, the one thing he had was 1Q amplification in his FISH was the only clue that he would have such a tough time. But essentially, despite RVD-based induction remission treatment and transplant, followed by RVD consolidation and Len maintenance, he had progressed literally within 1 year from his autograft, which is an ominous sign. He then got actually salvaged with carfilzomib-based therapy and pomalidomide, which unfortunately didn't control his disease even for more than about 8 months, as I recall. And then we were able to actually, and this is very interesting, we were able to salvage him for actually a while, almost 2 years, with a combination of RVD plus panobinostat, which was really interesting. This was part of a clinical trial. And then, unfortunately, he progressed. We gave him daratumumab-based therapy, re-challenged him with pomalidomide, and he'd actually done very well with bortezomib, so we used that again. Again, disease control was not particularly long. It was around 6 months. He then progressed, but we felt he was an excellent candidate for CAR-T, so he subsequently participated in a CAR-T program, BCMA targeted. He actually had a great response and tolerated the CAR-T well, but then unfortunately, after achieving a high quality response, he enjoyed that CR for less than a year and then progressed. So we're now thinking about what do we do next? And that's kind of where we sit right now.
Could you talk a little bit about what happened when he got the CAR-T and what kind of tolerability toxicity he had?
Yes. No, he did. I have to be very clear about this. This was a patient I was helping in his management, and I have been helping subsequently. But the actual CAR T therapy was run by one of my colleagues. And basically, he did very well through his CAR T. He had some mild CRS, mild to moderate, I would say. He did not have a severe neurological syndrome, and he did very well with it, and he had a very high quality response. I think the important point for him, though, was that it was relatively short-lived. It was less than a year. And when he did progress, now we're sitting on this, what do we do now? Fortunately, his progression has not been explosive, which is good. But nonetheless, we are scratching our heads because he's been through everything. You know, he's obviously had autologous grafting, he's had cuff fills, maybe he's had pomalidomide, he's had cellular therapy. And the question really now is, where do we go? Options would include, protocols are obviously my gearing point. If protocols don't apply for him in any way, I would say that in the STORM study, we did see responses in two patients in whom CAR T had failed them. So selinexor is one good option for him, in fact, in combination. And I would probably use it with bortezomib based upon what we know from early phase studies. STOMP, actually, it's not just Boston. The STOMP trial has looked at the combination of bortezomib and seli, as well as selinexor and daratumumab. We actually had presentations on the daratumumab seli data at EHA, where the response is around 84% to the combination. So I'm not sure I'd go back to Dara quite yet, but certainly seli bortezomib would be an excellent choice in my view for this guy.
Seli, that's interesting. So can you kind of update us a little bit on where we are with CAR T and myeloma? Initially, there was a lot of excitement, and then I kind of started hearing more about cases like this. First of all, just globally, what do you see in terms of initial response rate and duration response? And why do you think it is that it's not as effective as maybe we hoped?
Well, great question, Neil. I think what we've seen with CAR T therapy is the very high quality of responses has been impressive, and the CR and MRD rates have been striking. And I'm particularly impressed by Dr. Nuparaje's paper published in New England Journal from the BB2121 platform. Beautiful study, very well conducted, excellent results. I think the striking thing to me has been that the duration of disease control from the modality has been relatively short. Overall, about a year. And in those patients who achieved high quality response, longer, but again, relatively unstable. And what I think mean by that is that I think maintenance is going to be an essential part of how we build on CAR T. The fact that these were such sick patients, they were all so heavily pretreated, means that the modality, in my opinion, will be approved in the medium to longer term. The real question will be, how do we optimize its performance? And in that regard, I think the use of rational maintenance makes great sense to me. The tolerability is very important to understand because in the BB2121 experience, we had our patients, one of our patients in particular, ran into real difficulty with a neurological syndrome. Fortunately, she got through it, and she did well for a while, but then she subsequently has relapsed. But my point is, for her in particular, the neurological syndrome was life-threatening. So I think we need to be careful about toxicities and learn how to better manage them. And I think we've always had the excitement of IL-6 antibody therapy, which has been really effective in controlling some key aspects of the cytokine release syndrome. But there's a vascular component to the cytokine release syndrome that follows that can be more challenging. And we're looking at a variety of important strategies to try and overcome that. And I'm very hopeful they will bear fruit.
Vascular as in hypotension?
Yeah, it's a cytokine release syndrome that then is followed by almost a microangiopathy that follows. This may be part of the neurological syndrome as well. It's more typically seen in the leukemia and lymphoma setting. To be fair, so it's different platforms. And again, I would never pretend to be a CAR T expert, so I would have to defer to my CAR T colleagues. But I would say to you that there is clearly a vascular component, and certainly in the myeloma space, which I know obviously better, there appears to be a biphasic pattern to this toxicity with the cytokine release dominating early, and that may be particularly IL-6 antibody responsive. But there's a second phase that you have to use steroids, and if you don't and it's not effective, it can be very challenging. And even if you do use steroids, it can
vascular,
be...
Vascular, like what?
And it appears to be more vascular.
But I mean,
more
the,
of an angiopathy.
Angiopathy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how does it manifest clinically?
Well, it's very interesting. The clinical manifestations, obviously, in the severe form of the neurological syndrome, where literally you get vascular leak in the brain, for want of a better description, but at the same time, and you get cerebral edema and so forth. I think the important point is to realize that this is actually not perhaps unexpected, because you can see similar syndromes in allotransplant, albeit affecting different organ structures. And I think that in that context, we're fascinated by strategies we use successfully in allotransplant to obviate things like veno-occlusive disease, sinusoidal obstruction. Will those same strategies have value in CAR-T toxicities? And we'll see. And we've been developing these ideas for a while now, actually over several years, and clinical trials in this space are actually about to get underway.
So I was just imagining what it must be like to make rounds with you. But anyhow, let's do one more case real quick. How about this 62-year-old man? What happened there?
Yeah, he's very interestingly IgD lambda by isotype, diagnosed in 2015. And basically, he received initial treatment with RVD followed by RV maintenance. And he basically was reluctant to consider a transplant. We had actually offered it to him, and we consider it an appropriate option, actually. But he had chosen really rather to keep it in reserve. We'd also given him the option of carfilzomib early. But he did have a significant history of hypertension. So we were understanding RVD seemed like a reasonable choice. So he got RVD and RV maintenance. Now, when he relapsed, we did do a follow-up bone marrow, and he clearly has translocation 11-14 on FISH. So our next thinking for him was carfilzomib, because his hypertension is well controlled. He doesn't have cardiac disease. And the important point is that now in the relapse setting, we think carfilzomib is clearly justified. And at the same time, we're very impressed by the carfilzomib venetoclax data in 11-14 patients. Obviously, the safety hold applied to Bellini was driven primarily by the signal seen in the non-11-14 patients. And when we were able to move across to carfilzomib and venetoclax in this case, this would be a very appropriate option, in my opinion, for this patient.
And what's the patient's current situation?
Well, basically, we'd suggested stem cell transplantation, as I mentioned, but he really did want to keep it in reserve. He's a single father. He has a number of younger daughters, teenagers, and he's the caregiver for them. So he really didn't want to be out as a parent in that situation. So he really wants to keep it in reserve, and he continues to work full time. So we recommended the carfilzomib, which we ultimately dosed at 36 milligrams per meter squared. It's being given on the twice a week schedule at this point, because obviously we don't have single infusion data for the combination with venetoclax. So we're being a little careful there. So he's getting day 1, 2, 7, 8, 15, 16 every 28 days, and continuous dosing of venetoclax, which we started low and built up. We don't go to 800. That, of course, is what was prescribed in the Bellini trial. We have not done that, and he's currently at 400 milligrams. He's tolerating the treatment remarkably well, and he clearly has responded very nicely. And the really nice thing for this gentleman is that this is a very, you know, we're hoping we can get a lot of time from this regimen for him, and we still have Dara, pomalidomide, ixazomib. You know, we have multiple options for him in the future.
So getting back to venetoclax, what do we know at this point? There was initially the issue with increased death rate with venetoclax, and I know there was some further looking at those data. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. Now, I've seen the Bellini data, and they're very important. Again, they get back to this observation that we made very much earlier, that, you know, you can see modalities generate PFS advantage, because that always translates into an OS advantage. Well, in transplant, as you know, we see big PFS advantage, but do we see a big OS advantage? We don't. What we see with Bellini is striking PFS advantage, no question, across the whole trial. What's shocking, actually, is there's actually a major survival disadvantage. And so it points to there's just not no OS advantage. There's actually a loss of survival advantage, but that is confined to the non-11-14 patients. So I think in a way, the story in transplant of venetoclax has some resonance, because what it's telling you is clearly venetoclax works for those who've got 11-14. In fact, if you look at the hazard ratios for clinical benefit in the 11-14s, they're like 0.2, they're, or even less actually. They're striking. So with 11-14, clearly venetoclax is a beneficial drug, no question. What's so interesting is that in addition to toxicity in the non-11-14s, they actually, when they relapse, appear to do worse. And why?
And that's, I think, an open question. And the really important sort of observation is that it's not just toxicity that's the issue. It's something about the way the disease changes after venetoclax exposure, perhaps, that's leading to this worse outcome. So in a funny kind of way, it does resonate with the context of transplant, which is to say, you know, there are subsets of patients who you're clearly helping. There may be some in whom you're actually not helping them. You may be even hurting them. And it may not just be side effects. It may be something more. And my analogy is, you know, think Pandora's box. Is in some way venetoclax in the non-1114s destabilizing the genome and generating a Pandora's box effect, which it's not doing in the 1114s as an apoptotic agent? And I would argue that that's obviously an area, you know, which is being carefully looked at by the sponsors. But it certainly, to my mind, just like transplant, it says venetoclax, if you've got 1114, is clearly incredibly valuable. You know, transplant for certain patients clearly is a winner. But there are some patients in whom it's not. And in the case of venetoclax, I would argue if you're 1114 negative and say 1Q amplified, should you get venetoclax? Right now, based upon what we know, no. Not unless it's part of a very carefully controlled and well thought out clinical trial.